It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived, and we're glad to have Stefan Schmidt with us, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio, I believe. Hello, Stefan.
Hi. Pleasure to be with you.
Tim Hagel is with us in our Iowa City studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Thank you, Tim, for coming in today.
Hey there.
Very cold day. Both of you braced yourself against the cold to heat up some of our political discussion today. We want to start off this hour. Later in the hour, we'll talk about a new Quinnipiac poll that's just out this morning that looks at 2016 presidential hopefuls in swing states. Of course, Iowa being one of those swing states, along with Colorado and Virginia in this poll. Interesting findings there. We'll have Stefan and Tim comment about that a little bit later. Also, the immigration debate, the next latest chapter, I should say, is that the Obama administration putting its new deportation relief program on hold right on the eve of its launch. It was to be launched today, complying with a federal judge's order, a stay that happened Monday night. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. But first, we want to look at how 2016 candidates are investing in state politicians in Iowa, also in New Hampshire, through their PACs. Joining us to help do that is Michael Beckel. He's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Michael, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
Now, you've written an article recently titled Potential 2016 Candidates Prime Iowa and New Hampshire with Cash. Let's understand, because it's fascinating, what's going on here. In your article, you highlight, to begin with, one example of how this works by writing about Senator Rand Paul's support of Iowa Republican State Representative Bobby Kaufman, the 29-year-old chairman of Iowa House's Government Oversight Committee. Outline, what is the relationship and how have they been working with each other?
Well, the 2016 presidential race is actively underway, and one of the things that potential contenders like Senator Rand Paul are doing are trying to build relationships with folks on the ground in Iowa, like State Representative Bobby Kaufman. We saw this with Senator Rand Paul. We saw this with former Texas Governor Rick Perry and a host of other high-profile Republicans who are potentially going to be seeking the GOP nomination. They spent a lot of time on the ground in Iowa going to events, headlining fundraisers, headlining rallies, and even themselves donating money to these state-level politicians in Iowa and New Hampshire, and they're able to do this through political committees that they operate called leadership PACs or federal PACs, and these are political committees that the high-profile politicians can operate and raise money for and then support like-minded candidates, and the money that these PACs give out is one way that these politicians help cultivate relationships on the ground with local power players.
So these well-known national figures are coming to Iowa to lend their support to people who do not have national name recognition, for sure. They are state politicians. They go to campaign fundraisers for them. They donate. They have their PACs donate for them. And what's interesting in the article that you wrote, surprising perhaps, is that in this case, Representative Bobby Kaufman gets this support, financial support, and he doesn't even have to say he endorses Rand Paul.
Yeah, it is very early in the process. And so a lot of these potential contenders have spent a lot of time in recent weeks and recent months during the 2014 midterm election building relationships on the ground with these lawmakers and other potential candidates. Some of the money went to folks as high as U.S. Senator, U.S. House, and all the way down the ticket to state representatives, state lawmakers, even sheriff candidates in New Hampshire. They are trying to build relationships with these folks who are going to be as likely to attend the Iowa caucuses as anyone else and may also bring a following with them. And on the flip side, the local lawmakers, the local candidates are able to bring in more energy and sometimes fundraising dollars by throwing these types of rallies and events with a headliner from someone like Senator Rand Paul. That brings a lot more attention. Some sometimes media attention, sometimes just, say, a couple hundred more people into a community center in Wilton, Iowa, where folks want to hear what Senator Rand Paul has to say and are more likely then to be engaged with the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Past the sort of short-term benefit that each gets, as you've just described, what expectations do these 2016 hopefuls have when they contribute to a state legislator's campaign in a couple of different ways?
Well, when I interviewed folks for the article that we published at the Center for Public Integrity, everyone that I spoke with said that, you know, we're not talking about a quid pro quo. There was not an ask for a specific action in return for the contribution. But they all seem to say that these types of transactions help cultivate friendships or relationships. You know, they want somebody to return their calls. They want somebody to know who they are in a crowd and in a crowded field, a potentially very crowded Republican primary field. Anything that they can do to set themselves apart could yield dividends down the road as you talk about what's going to be happening in Iowa a year from today.
How much money is being spent this way?
Well, this is something that is very much at the early stages, but in the last 2 years, during 2013 and 2014, we saw about $150,000 being funneled to politicians and political groups in Iowa, and about $190,000 being funneled from these political action committees to politicians in New Hampshire. And what was really striking was, not only are you talking about $1,000 here or $5,000 there, but for some of these high-profile Republicans who are considering presidential runs, a outsized portion of their money was really focused on Iowa and New Hampshire. Hmm. Governor Rick Perry, for instance, the former governor of Texas, he raised and doled out about $100,000 to politicians in Iowa and New Hampshire. Overall, about $100,000, and about 95% of that was focused on Iowa and New Hampshire. So even though that's not the largest sum of money, you could tell that it was very much targeted towards politicians in these two key early states.
Now, we have a few on the Democratic side, very few. Hillary Clinton is the big figure, of course, as a Democratic hopeful. Would this be happening on the Democratic side if they had to a whole host of potential candidates as well?
Absolutely. If you go back and look at what happened in 2007 and 2006 during the very, very heated primary campaign between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, you saw both of them engaging with Iowans and New Hampshireites with their leadership PAC giving. And even in the past 2 years, you've seen somebody like former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley investing a lot in early states through a leadership PAC similar to the ones that we outlined about the Republican contenders.
Michael Beckel is a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, just written an article on how 2016 candidates are investing in state politicians in Iowa, also in New Hampshire, through their PACs. Stephen Schmidt and Tim Hagel with us. Just wondered your thoughts at this point, Stephen Schmidt, while we're on this topic. This is something that a lot of us didn't know was going on, but I'm sure you were aware of it.
Well, yeah, you know, politicians have always tried to cultivate precinct captains and community leaders in their party in order to get that grassroots mobilization. And the Iowa caucuses have always been, you know, classically a grassroots mobilization event. You can buy commercials, but they, you know, what you have to do is get to those 150,000 people in your party or however many there are who are going to go to the caucuses. And that's a relatively small number. And it's more effective to do that by approaching opinion leaders and party organizers. On the other hand, I don't know how much money Rick Santorum shoveled at local political officials in the last caucuses. I don't think it was much because he was the guy who didn't have any money, and yet he won the Iowa caucuses. So I'm a little bit dubious that you can correlate schmear money and walking around money, as they call it in the South, with actual results in the Iowa caucuses. It's interesting, but I would like to see a correlation or at least a relationship between spending that money on local politicians and the results on caucus night.
Mm-hmm. Michael Beckel, have you looked into that at all, how effective this form of investment by these candidates is?
Well, I think one of the initial findings that that is particularly clear is that at this stage in the game, none of these candidates that we looked at have declared themselves to be official presidential candidates. Yet through these PACs, they're certainly acting like them. They have been investing money and time in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and the political action committees that they operate allow them to start laying the groundwork long before they officially declare themselves to be candidates. So whether or not the investments they make translate into success on caucus night, these are still vehicles that they are able to use long before that official campaign period starts. And that's one of the things that's so fascinating about this.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts?
Yeah, a couple of things. The first is I'm just shocked that national politicians want to make friends in Iowa. Who knew, you know? No, I'm kidding, of course. You know, part of the thing, and following up on Michael's last point there, is that even though some of these folks haven't necessarily declared, and of course we're expecting several of them to eventually declare officially, but as we know here in Iowa, not everybody that's running for president is running for president. So even to the extent that somebody may be sort of testing the waters but doesn't mount a full-fledged campaign, sort of helping other Republicans, kind of developing the people at the state house level and congressional level that may, you know, help the party in the long term.
If you're not running for president, why are you looking like a presidential hopeful? What could be other explanations?
Explanations: are you running for vice president? You're looking for a cabinet slot. You're trying to raise your national profile, and not to be too cynical, but you're trying to sell books, perhaps, or get a TV gig of some sort. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why you do it. Or you're running for president down the line. I mean, some people are sort of suggesting that Martin O'Malley, if Hillary Clinton gets in, he has like zero chance. And if she doesn't, maybe he does have a chance, but he's perhaps looking for something down the line, 2020, 24, something like that, because he's on the younger side, so he's got some time. So, sometimes it's a matter of developing either your own prospects down the road or developing the party as a whole, supporting people. And of course, here in Iowa in 2014, we had three open races, one Senate and two U.S. House races. And so a lot of people contributed to that just because they wanted to see Republicans in those offices.
Michael Beckel, will you be following up this report, this article, with other looks at the process as we head towards 2016?
Yes, here at the Center for Public Integrity, we will be following all the money coming into the presidential election, whether that's through political action committees like these or some of the other groups that are already active in the 2016 race. We're seeing these traditional PACs being operated by several candidates. We're also seeing super PACs, the newer committees that are allowed to accept unlimited amounts of money from donors for independent ads that are aired, popping up in the 2016 race this early in the process. So we know that the 2016 race is going to be a very expensive contest, and we plan on following that money and writing stories about it on the Center for Public Integrity.
Okay, Michael Beckel, a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to your further reporting.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, Tim Hagel with us of the University of Iowa, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. And now we wanted to go back to our regular formula of looking at sort of developments on the political landscape as they have appeared. Let's stay for the moment, if we could, Stefan and Tim, with 2016 presidential politics. Latest poll, this is from Quinnipiac University. Yeah, it's a swing state poll released early today. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton runs best overall against leading Republican White House contenders in three critical swing states, Colorado, Virginia, and yes, here in Iowa. But U.S. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky in a virtual tie with her in Colorado and Virginia. Another note here, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush ties Clinton in Virginia. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is in a virtual tie with her in Colorado. A lot of things to sort out here, Tim Hagel. I don't know if you've had time yet today to sort out that poll. What do you see there that's interesting?
Well, let me start by saying that I don't attach a whole lot of meaning to any of these early polls. And one of the things we've seen over the last couple of days is that as each poll comes out, somebody new is at the top. And the race, usually this is, of course, on the Republican side. For the Democrats, of course, it's going to be Hillary Clinton until she gets some serious competition or drops out of the race. But for the Republican side, and these polls are just so early that you can't really attach a whole lot of meaning to them. On the other hand, it is good to know, I suppose, at this early date, sort of what Republican candidates, whoever they may be, are up against in terms of Hillary Clinton. She's certainly a well-known person, has been in public eye for 25 years. And so some of these Republicans don't have that name recognition, even when you are talking like a Rand Paul, whose father had ran last time around, or Jeb Bush, of course, because of the Bush name. But these folks haven't really started their campaign yet, so it's all very early and not very clear. And of course, they're also polling people that are just not necessarily likely voters, all maybe just registered voters, and that usually gives us a different view of things. So it gives us some information, but like I said, don't put too much weight on these things.
What do you see in this latest poll, Stefan?
Well, I mean, there are some names that are popping up, and it tells me that the pollsters are testing these hypothetical horse races against certain candidates, and others are just not even in the mix. And that can be an interesting indicator of where pollsters and the news media are kind of directing their attention and directing their interest. The Republicans do have this enormous field that has got to be winnowed down. And I guess if I were a candidate running on the or hopefully running or pretending to run on the Republican side, I'd actually like my name to be in this particular poll matched up against Hillary Clinton, because if it's not there, it means I'm being just totally ignored.
One interesting thing drawn from this poll is that in each of the swing states polled by Quinnipiac University, Jeb Bush's family ties to the White House have more of a negative impact than Hillary Clinton's ties to the White House. Can you explain that, Tim?
Well, the common phrase for that is Bush fatigue. And you see this is something, of course, that Democrats have pushed, but it's not exclusive to Democrats or a number of Republicans, more libertarian-oriented mm-hmm. or Tea Party folks who are concerned about the size of government that they portrayed both Bushes, 41 and 43, as being eventually big government Republicans. And they're not particularly fond of that and were disappointed with George W. Bush towards the end of his presidency. So they're not particularly happy about the thought of another Bush in the White House, even though what Jeb Bush has to do is show how he is his own man to the extent that he wants to run.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, the poorest performing Republican in this poll. Does that surprise you, Stefan?
No. Chris Christie has been having a real problem in recent weeks. His abrasive personality is, I think, hurting him. Even though he's trying to sort of correct himself and be Mr. Nice Guy, the last time he was here in Iowa, he was very, very quiet and smooth. But his glitches over in London, and his periodic little outbursts, plus the fact that the state of New Jersey is in not great shape. And there are some polls in New Jersey that show that voters in New Jersey actually don't think that he's a qualified candidate for president. Those things all really, really eat away at especially the connection between candidates and people who write checks for them. So I think Chris Christie is struggling.
Back to the point of possible Bush fatigue, as you mentioned there, Tim. Today, perhaps at this very time, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is using a foreign policy speech in Chicago to confront what is being called the biggest shadow hanging over his campaign, this connection with his father and his brother. Now, these are some remarks leaked by his political action committee that will try to create a little distance between him and his brother and his father. Quote, "I love my father and my brother. I admire their service to the nation and the difficult decisions they had to make. But," he says, "but I am my own man, and my views are shaped by my own thinking and own experiences." Stefan, is this his biggest hurdle at this point, to decouple himself from the Bush two prior Bush presidents?
Well, especially the second Bush, because Bush 1 was actually, you know, fairly successful and didn't get the United States stuck in a morass and didn't pull off, you know, some foreign policy moves that we're still living and perhaps living more than before with the consequences of destabilizing Iraq. So he definitely has got to, you know, pull away from W's policies and also some of the other things that W was associated with that basically turned away even Republicans after a while. And he does have to say, you know, there is no Bush dynasty. I learned a lot from my dad and my brother about public service, but you know, this is a different period and I'm a different Bush. So yeah, he does have to do that, and it must be terribly difficult, you know, because I know that, you know, he loves his dad, he loves his brother, but this is politics, and all is, you know, fair and in love and politics.
Is that his biggest challenge, to Tim Hagel, to first of all, at least initially, get away from his brother, so to speak?
It's an odd thing because he's got to get past, of course, the Republican primary season. He's got to get the nomination. But even if he gets the nomination, he's still going to have to face that because that will certainly be a line of criticism from the Democrats. But even in the Republican primary lead up, as Stefan was saying, and I'd said before too, that there's some Republicans are just not real keen on that. And I think Jeb can probably make his case. And a lot of Republicans would be willing to listen to that case. But his bigger problem may end up being some specific issue areas, particularly immigration and Common Core. And I think that you can make that case. And we just hope that he comes to Iowa early and often, maybe not early at this point, but at least often, and makes that case to Iowa voters. And of course, he'll have to do it in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and the other states as well.
Rand Paul, according to the New York Times, is considering an April 7th launch for his presidential bid. We have just a few seconds left. Stefan, when do candidates declare? Is the time coming when they all have to, or some of them have to?
You know, it just really depends. I mean, obviously, in the case of Jeb Bush, he wants to make sure that he reassures and nails down donors so that they don't say, well, you know, unless he makes up his mind, I'm giving it to someone else. Hillary Clinton doesn't have to declare. You know, she can wait.
Okay. We'll be back with Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our political analysts, on this Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll talk about this Texas U.S. District Court judge's ruling that has put the Obama administration's executive order, the new deportation relief program, on hold. We'll talk about that when we come back, the next latest chapter in the immigration debate. It's Politics Wednesday. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, back in just a few minutes. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday. We have Tim Hagel with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Stefan in Ames. Tim is in our Iowa City studio. And we're, as we like to do on Wednesdays, chewing over the latest political developments and also getting analysis from Tim and Stefan. A little later in the program, this is something we're going to do with our social media. We want to mark President's Day, but we're belatedly doing that. Of course, that was Monday of this week. We wanted to have you rate president's popularity and answer this question. Who's your favorite president in your lifetime and why? Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page is ready for your response to that question. Your favorite president in your lifetime and why? You can leave that message on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. You could also email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'll certainly be asking Stefan and Tim that question a little bit later in the program. Let's talk, though, about a development yesterday. The Obama administration put its new deportation relief program on hold on the eve of its launch. The launch was to be today. The administration complying, reluctantly, it must be said, with a federal judge's order, the ruling late Monday night in a case brought by 26 states, led by Texas, said that Obama and his Homeland Security Department lacked the authority to take the actions they did. Tim Hagel, you are a lawyer. Tell us what's behind this ruling.
Well, it's The ruling itself, the opinion that the judge wrote was some 123 pages long, and I didn't read the whole thing, but the nuggets that I saw basically can boil it down to the fact that the judge said that to the extent that the administration doesn't want to deport certain people, that they can do that in terms of prosecutorial discretion. So that they say, well, just we aren't going to enforce this particular law. The problem that the judge had, the federal judge had, was that the administration was going beyond that, that it was also putting benefits or giving benefits to these people, allowing them to work and things of that nature and giving them other benefits that the law did not provide. And so through the executive action, the judge felt that the administration was changing the law, something that it couldn't do. And so it put an injunction on the order. And basically this is something that, and in fact, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said that they weren't, the administration would appeal this quickly. So it undoubtedly will be reviewed by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and perhaps ultimately by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, the administration is suspending its plans to allow undocumented immigrants to apply for legal status. He is planning, the president plans to appeal the ruling. Here's what he had to say.
The only way we're going to get a broken immigration system fully fixed is by Congress acting. And we know that there has been bipartisan support in the past for comprehensive immigration reform. I held off taking these executive actions until we had exhausted all possibilities of getting congressional action done. With a new Congress, my hope has been that they now get serious in solving the problem. Instead, what we've had is a series of votes to kick out young people who have grown up here and everybody recognizes are part of our community, and threats to defund the Department of Homeland Security, which would make it even harder for us to protect our borders and to keep our people safe.
Okay. Stephen Schmidt, what position does this put the president in with this latest ruling? And he mentioned the other facet that we're putting in here as well, defunding of the Department of Homeland Security, which is involves Congress.
Well, I mean, the one thing that we need to talk about is how long have we had this immigration problem? How long have there been 11, I've seen the number 11 million people illegal in the U.S. for years. So there aren't like 11 million plus one or 12 million. We don't know the numbers. It's been forever. They've been here. There isn't really any urgency. There's not a crisis. And so all of this is a kind of a chess game that's being played between the president, who wants to reform immigration, and who knows that the Latino and Hispanic voters have been an important and growing piece of the American voting public. And immigration reform is a big issue for them. And the Republicans, who have also been able to essentially make a lot of hay out of taking a tough line on immigration. The constituencies that Steve King and other Republicans have want illegal immigrants to be kept out of the country and kicked out of the country. And so it's a very interesting, you know, political game of chicken that's going on. And it's also fascinating to see the most powerful man in the world being basically stopped dead in his tracks by some judge that conservatives shopped for in Texas who would come out with this ruling. I mean, it's fascinating. Very few leaders around the world would let some obscure federal judge, stop them from executing something which they think is constitutional. So it's a fascinating story.
Now, the president and U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder have said this will undoubtedly go to a higher court to be decided. Tim Hagel, you think that's in the offing?
Well, it'll certainly go to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the next step. This was came out of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas. And so the next rung up the judicial ladder is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Whether the U.S. Supreme Court takes it, that's a little bit more of an open question. It depends on the questions of standing and what the federal issues are and so forth and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Let me just follow up one thing that Stefan said in terms of how one federal judge can have the power to stop the leader of the free world, the president of the United States. That's something that's not unusual, and we've seen this many times before, where not just where the judge has blocked something that the president has done, but something that Congress has passed and the president has signed, and it still can be challenged, and one federal judge can at least temporarily put a halt to it. Now, again, they always have to go through the rest of the process and go up through potentially the judicial branch to a court of appeals and the Supreme Court. But we've seen this many times before. If there's some law that, that somebody thinks is controversial, and yeah, you do get that kind of judge shopping going on.
Now, this ruling comes as Congress debates how to extend funding authority for the Department of Homeland Security. Stefan, explain to us, how did this immigration debate get mixed up with funding for Homeland Security?
Well, you know, that's the magic of American politics, is that you can put non-germane things onto bills that are crucially important. You know, it's typically you add something that you want passed to the national defense spending bill, because it's very difficult to not vote for the national defense, to fund national defense, and it's very difficult for presidents to not sign legislation that funds the Defense Department. And if you stick these things on these crucial bills, you can get all kinds of stuff passed. It's one of the anomalies of American legislative process, and something that is, in my opinion at least, leads to this enormous amount of pork and special interest legislation that makes it through Congress through this mechanism.
Now, on Fox News Sunday, House Speaker John Boehner said that he certainly is willing to let the funding for the Department of Homeland Security run out if Congress doesn't authorize funding for the department by February 28th. Here's what he had to say.
The House has done its job under the Constitution. It's time for the Senate to do their job. Listen, I've got a tough job here. So does Senator McConnell. But Senate Democrats are the ones standing in the way. They're the ones jeopardizing funding. Why don't they get on the bill and offer an amendment? Offer their ideas. Let's see what the Senate can do.
Speaker Boehner emphasized this point by stating at an earlier press conference that if the Department of Homeland Security funding runs out, Senate Democrats are to blame.
The House has done its job. Why don't you go ask the Senate Democrats when they're going to get off their ass and do something other than to vote no?
Okay, now Congress, members of Congress are in recess. Always good for a colorful quote, John Boehner. Congress is in recess this week in observance of President's Day. They're going to be reconvening next Monday. So where are we at, Stefan? This ruling comes down. How might this court ruling change the standoff between Congress and the president?
Well, unless the Republicans in the House and Senate somehow get together and agree on something that they can cobble together in conference and get some Democrats to vote for it, I guess, the standoff continues. I'm not sure that this in any way sort of stops that process, because the stay that the judge issued is very temporary, and the Republicans know fully well that Obama is going to push to make legal and legitimate his order. And so I just don't see that it's going in any other direction.
On the other hand, that's one possibility. But I saw a point made in a website, Legal Insurrection, which I thought was pretty good, where a lot of people basically think that the Republicans have put themselves in a bit of a box in challenging the constitutionality of what the president did. And to some extent, this may give them what some have called an off-ramp or a way out of the box, in the sense that given the portion of the president's action that Republicans objected to is put on hold, they can go ahead and fund Department of Homeland Security without worrying about any money going to the portion of it that they didn't like, which is the executive order portion. And then if eventually the courts hold that the president's action was in fact constitutional, well, the Republicans can say, well, we tried, they held it constitutional, so there's not much more we can do about it. So in a sense, it gives them an opportunity. Now, the question, of course, is, and this may be getting back to Stefan's point, will they actually take that possibility, that off-ramp? That's, we have to wait and see.
Tim Hagel is with us of the University of Iowa, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. It's Politics Wednesday. We have about 10 minutes left of the program. Wanted to tackle another couple of things. At least every week we have, it seems, more outrage provoked by the self-proclaimed Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL. A few days ago, the group's murder of 21 Egyptian Christians. The previous week, a Jordanian pilot burned alive in a cage on video. And last week, President Obama, a president we have to say renowned for his restraint and for his downplaying of dangers, asked Congress for authorization for use of military force. I wanted to share with you, Stefan and Tim, several polls about that reflect what we must now question as a war-weary American public. The latest CNN poll says 78% of Americans in favor of authorizing further actions against the Islamic State, follows an earlier CNN poll that showed 80% supporting the request. Another poll by NBC News and Marist College that found that even when Obama's name is attached to the question, only 32% of respondents object. Now, it's interesting here when we talk about the politics of this that John McCain on NBC's Meet the Press this Sunday says he opposes any war resolution that puts limits on the power of the president. Let's listen.
I think we should not restrain the president of the United States. The Congress has the power of the purse. If we don't like what the commander-in-chief is doing, we can cut off his funds for doing so. But to restrain him in our authorization of him taking military action, I think, frankly, is unconstitutional and eventually leads to 535 commanders-in-chief.
Okay, that's Senator McCain this weekend. The military authorization the president is asking for would be the first since President George W. Bush got one, his second authorization in the fall of 2002, and using that to invade Iraq. So, Stefan, what do you see when you look at the politics of this authorization working its way through Congress?
Well, it's very difficult, given the brutality of what's going on, not to have public opinion say we need to do something about it. And it's very difficult for the members of Congress not to want the president to take action. The problem with this particular authorization the president is asking for is that it's another typical Obama waffle, you know, in which he sort of asks for it, but nobody's sure that he doesn't want troops committed, boots on the ground. He's giving his opponents a timeline, so if they want to wait for 3 years to then really sort of take on the world, the U.S. is going to, you know, butt out after 3 years. And so it's just a mixture of all kinds of contradictory signals that are going out. And there are a lot of people who don't want to give Obama this authorization simply because it just once again gives an opportunity to continue to engage the United States in conflicts, which a lot of people actually, in spite of public opinion polls, think, maybe are not our fight. That, you know, the states of the Middle East, the Islamic world, is not putting boots on the ground. It is not really committing to fighting this as much, and it's in their neighborhood.
We also have, within the president's own party, some reservations for this one word that pops out of here, actually a phrase from the authorization. President Obama said in the authorization, it precludes enduring offensive ground combat operations. So I guess enduring is something that some people in his own party are worried about. What is an enduring operation?
Well, that's the point. And of course, they would always turn to what happened under President George W. Bush in the sense that that was their big complaint. That was the thing that one of their major campaign themes for particularly 2006 when Democrats retook control of both houses of Congress. And of course, then in the 2008 campaign, that was one of the things that hurt Hillary Clinton was that she had voted in favor of the war authorization. And so it's not surprising that Democrats are not happy about that. And to a certain extent, asking for that limitation allows some Democrats to say, okay, you know, we don't want the enduring war. We don't want to go through this again, but this is different. And so they can sort of change their position, but have an explanation behind it. But as Stefan was saying, that sometimes this can seem to other people as being waffling. There are also some Republicans and maybe others as well that will not particularly want to give Obama this authorization because they don't feel he's competent to exercise it effectively.
Mm-hmm. So where does that leave it? Will the president get this authorization or not, Stefan?
Probably yes. Yeah, I mean, look, you know, if I had a crystal ball, I wouldn't be sitting here in this room. You'd have to call me long distance in Washington, D.C. at a think tank.
Yes, after some period of time, in the immediate future, Tim Hagel?
Gee, I'm surprised Stefan said Washington. I would have said Vegas, that, you know, make the money. I would go with Stefan. He'd probably get that authorization. There's going to be more arguments about it. But Stefan also made a previous point that was good, too, that a lot of people are saying, well, look, is this really our fight? And, you know, we've seen these terrible scenes. You talked about the ones that with the 21 Coptic Christians that were killed, the Jordanian pilot that was burned alive. But then I was thinking, you know, what about some of the other atrocities that are happening in some other countries that people want us to get involved in? And so far, we haven't gotten involved to the extent that people have been, you know, it's just not in the news as much, and people have been arguing for it. But we've said, no, we really can't do that. So why here? Why not there? Those are the questions that continue to arise.
Well, yeah, Nigeria comes to mind.
Yep. Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left. I wanted to run by this by you gentlemen because we marked President's Day on Monday of this week. And so belatedly, we want to look at a Washington Post survey of 162 members of something called the American Political Science Association's Presidents and Executive Politics section. Ask them to rate U.S. presidents, the most highly rated presidents. You can probably guess, throw out the names, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt. After that, Teddy Roosevelt, Thomas Jefferson, Truman, Eisenhower. Bill Clinton is then there in the top 10. Andrew Jackson, Woodrow Wilson, Ronald Reagan ranking 11th, and Obama coming in at 18th. So your thoughts. I wanted to ask you, Stefan, do you have a thought about the most overrated, underrated presidents, favorite presidents within your lifetime?
Gerald Ford.
Underrated or overrated?
You take a guess.
Well, I'm saying underrated because he's hardly on the radar at all.
He's never on the radar, but, you know, he sort of was there as a caretaker, made a transition, helped the country get from one giant trauma to a more stable place, and did it, you know, not elegantly, but did it, you know, effectively.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Tim Hagel, a favorite president that you have within your lifetime?
Well, being that I'm originally from Michigan, you might think that I would agree with Stefan about Gerald Ford being from Michigan, although he did graduate from the University of Michigan, so I'm not sure I like that particularly much as a Michigan State graduate. But I actually, during the primary of 1976, voted for Reagan over Ford. Mm-hmm. So Reagan is my fave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This week, this goes more to Iowa local politics. A businessman, Ravi Patel, announced he's running for Congress in Iowa's first congressional district. We just had an election, fellas. This is a 29-year-old businessman, Patel of Cedar Rapids. He announced his candidacy in the news release on Monday. He becomes the second Democrat to announce his intention to run for this Northeast Iowa district, the first being Cedar Rapids City Councilwoman Monica Vernon. So it's a seat newly won by the freshman Representative Rod Blum, a first-term Republican. Tim Hagel, they're seeing a vulnerable Republican in what, a Democratic district?
Yeah, the Democrats have a voter registration advantage in the first district. It's not as big as it is in the second, but of course the second is held by a Democrat, so that's not the one that's sort of on the top of their target list. And somebody, Mark Verda, declared early on, perhaps hoping to freeze out some of the competition, but now she's got a contender, which perhaps is going to be a good thing. It's better to sometimes have some competition in the primary season to help work out the kinks in your campaign, to sort of get the smooth communications and way you talk about issues. So it's a little strange that it's starting this early, but it's certainly understandable given the vulnerability that Democrats feel in Rod Blum.
And Stefan Schmidt, in the final minute, let me throw you this milestone. About 11.4 million people signed up for health coverage during the Affordable Care Act's second enrollment period, which ended this past Sunday. Is Obamacare... Will the Republicans be able to dismantle Obamacare?
Well, they're going to try because, you know, they say, well, 11 million, but how many of those, you know, are going to drop out and are not going to pay? And there's still all these people who have to pay fines. And when those people start getting fined for not having insurance, there's going to be this big uprising and we'll be on the right side killing Obamacare. And they hate it. You know, they don't like it. It's socialism and it's essentially something on which they can really mobilize the base. So the Affordable Health Care Act is becoming the health care system of the country, at least the insurance part of it. Everybody has reorganized the insurance industry and hospitals and others to comply with it. And so the longer it's there, the more it's going to be the way we do things. But the Republicans are still going to go after it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Stefan Schmidt, for spending the hour with us, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, and Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Thanks for braving the cold, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
To come into our studios. We'll look forward to having you back again. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. ¶¶